This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
This week, the government announced an overhaul of the UK's asylum system with the stated aim of making Britain look a lot less attractive to those planning to make their way across the Channel on a small boat or outstay their visa if already here. A raft of proposals include ending a refugee's effective right to stay in the country indefinitely, a quicker way of deporting those who fail in their asylum applications, and a less sympathetic approach to refugee families. Denmark has been held up in recent days as an example of a country with much tougher asylum policies. So, are we in the UK now part of a wider European trend of clamping down on asylum seekers? And what can we learn from the success or failure of other asylum policies across the continent? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at what these proposals are and who they're aimed at. Other than the voters, that is. I'm joined by Dr. Madeline Sumption, who's Director of the Migration Observatory at Oxford University. Madeline, can you remind us, please, briefly, what these new proposals of the government's are, the ones that really stand out?
Well, there's a lot in there, but I would say the key things are, firstly, that the government wants to have a more temporary status for refugees, so they will be reassessed more often to see if they can be returned to their country of origin. And they will be in that temporary status for up to 20 years, although it may be shorter for some people, for example, if they switch into work or study. The second thing they want to do is reduce the amount of financial support that asylum seekers get, particularly people who have the right to work while they're waiting for their asylum decision, and then potentially also reducing support for refugees who've been granted status as well. And then the third major thing they want to do is reduce the scope of the legal protections that people have that enable them either to get legal status or to challenge their removal from the UK. And they also want to make all of these legal decisions more quickly so that people who are unsuccessful at the end of that process can be removed faster.
Exactly who are these policies aimed at?
They're aimed at asylum seekers, so that's people who have come to the UK and are claiming refugee status, so saying that they have a well-founded fear of persecution in their country of origin. That would apply to people arriving on small boats, which obviously is the most visible piece of it, but it would also apply to people coming through other unauthorised routes or coming on visas and then claiming asylum.
What proportion of asylum seekers do actually arrive on small boats? Because they get all the attention. Are they the majority of people who come?
They are not the majority. Over the past year, it was 39% of people who claimed asylum had originally arrived on a small boat. We then got 11% coming through other unauthorised routes, like on lorries, and 37% of people coming on a visa or some other kind of permission. Usually that would be a study, a work or a visitor visa, and then a few other miscellaneous groups, such as people who arrived via the common travel area with Ireland.
Where does the UK sit when you compare the numbers of asylum seekers coming to Britain as opposed to the rest of Europe?
Last year, in absolute terms, the UK was the fifth largest recipient of asylum claims. So that's behind Germany, Spain, Italy and France. If you look at it per capita, obviously the UK has a big population. It's actually much lower down the list at number 17. If you think about the total share of the claims we're getting last year, if you add up all the claims made in EU countries plus the UK got 11%.
So per capita, we're 17th on that list.
That's right. And we've always had actually a very low share of the overall asylum claims in Europe. It's 11% currently, but that's much higher than it was in the past. So if you look back to pre-pandemic, it was more like 5 to 6% that the UK would receive.
In terms of the overall immigration picture, what proportion are asylum seekers of total immigration to the UK?
If you look at people immigrating to the UK of any nationality, then asylum claimants last year were around 10% of the total. Now, that share has actually roughly doubled since pre-pandemic, when it was around 5%. And it may grow further a bit because we've had a big decline in the non-asylum reasons for people coming to the UK, people coming for work and study.
What could we usefully say about the countries of origin of asylum seekers and the way it may have changed over the course of the last few years?
The countries of origin are constantly changing. There are some nationalities that are consistently high in the figures, like Afghans, for example, particularly after the fall of Kabul in 2021. We've seen periods when there have been higher numbers of Eritreans, people from Somalia, often high in the figures, Iran as well. And then you have some countries where actually people are less likely to be granted asylum, and we've had occasional spikes in those numbers. So there was a big spike in the number of Albanian asylum applicants in 2022, then more recently, Vietnamese applicants. So I think the picture is constantly changing in terms of the balance of where people come from.
Leaving the politics of this completely aside, why this overhaul of policy now?
Well, asylum applications in the UK have gone up. We've also seen the emergence of the small boats route really starting in 2018, but becoming much bigger over the last few years. And that's been a major political issue. And it's a very visible form of asylum-related migration, much more visible than people overstaying visas. There's also been a number of EU countries that have made restrictive moves. And so the UK may be wanting to emulate those countries.
If you could stay with us, please, Madeleine, because I now want to look at what other countries in Europe have been doing to tackle their own issues with asylum and what the UK can learn from them. Joining us are Professor Andrew Geddes, Director of the Migration Policy Centre at the European University Institute in Florence, and down the line from France, Susie Dennison, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Susie Dennison, the UK government seems, and we're told this, to have partly drawn on Denmark's asylum policies. Could you give us a brief outline of what those Danish policies are, please?
Essentially, what is referred to as the Danish model is a set of policies which have been put in place since asylum applications in Denmark spiked in around 2015. And there are two, I would say, pieces to this approach in Denmark. One is about making the system more effective, and the other is about making Denmark as a destination for asylum seekers less attractive. And the overall goal of this policy framework is, as Mette Frederiksen, the Danish Prime Minister, puts it, is to try to reach zero asylum seekers in the country. So essentially, the policy package is about much quicker processing times, but also making it much more difficult to stay in Denmark on a long-term basis. So there has been a significant reduction in the normal residency periods that are granted, even in the event of successful applications for refugee status, down to 1 to 2 years, which can be renewed. Much tougher rules around family reunification and access to the benefits system for those within Denmark who do receive refugee status, and then much tougher policies put in place on what are called returns. So for those people who've applied for asylum, but this application hasn't been granted, with the use of departure centres, i.e. sort of residencies for people with a view to them being more easily deported in the event of unsuccessful applications.
And what impact have those policies had?
Well, last year, the Danish government were reporting what they say are the lowest numbers in 40 years in terms of asylum applications in the country. They had, according to Refugees Welcome, which is a refugee organisation operating in Denmark, around 2,300 applications for asylum in 2024. And this is down from the spike, which I referred to earlier in 2015, of 20,000. So clearly, there is an impact of this broader approach. The other point, though, that I would highlight is that I think that the communications impact around this policy package is perhaps one of the most successful elements. There is a strong sense that the system is under control, which is reassuring to voters.
I think maybe we should just make the point that Denmark is quite a small country, and therefore the numbers we're talking about relative to other countries are not great.
Absolutely. And relative to other European countries, they have one of the lower rates in terms of the levels of asylum applications per capita in EU member states.
Andrew Geddes, let's look at who else has adopted quite tough policies. You're based in Italy, you have been for some time, and that's traditionally seen big numbers of asylum seekers arriving by boat from North Africa, particularly in recent years. So what has Italy been doing?
The immigration issue is the reason that Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni came to power in 2022 in a very big election victory for her. But if we look at what's happened in relation to asylum since 2022, well, we see that asylum numbers have actually doubled. So what you've got in Italy is an asylum system which is really creaking under the pressures. Around 200,000 people in Italy still awaiting a decision in a reception system which is really not fit for purpose, specifically on the controls. What we can see is that Italy's taken much tougher measures on smugglers. So using some of its laws that have been applied for mafia gangs to tackle smugglers, much tougher prison sentences, also crackdown on NGOs conducting what are called search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. And we can see some signs that this has been effective. So in 2023, there were 157,000 boat arrivals, and that fell back to 66,000 last year. It's not only about border controls, because Italy's looking to do deals with neighbouring countries, so it's provided equipment to the Libyans. It's done a deal with Tunisia, a quite significant EU-wide development, which is the Pact on Migration and Asylum. And Italy's hoping, and has hoped for quite a long time, that there might be more solidarity within the EU, more assistance to enable Italy as a frontline state to respond to the issues that it faces. And last but not least, Italy did a deal with Albania to establish processing centres on Albanian territory. And that has attracted a lot of attention, a lot of interest as a potential European model.
How does this hub idea work?
To be more precise about what's going on at the moment is how it hasn't worked rather than how it has worked. But the plan was agreed back in November 2023, and that was to send up to 36,000 asylum applicants, so people applying for asylum, be sent to two centres in Albania. And these centres would be technically Italian territory in Albania, where asylum claims will be processed. So if they were successful, they would be moved back to Italy. If they were not successful, they would be deported, although where to is not entirely clear. It's very expensive. So reported costs of this for a first five-year period are 670 million euros. Essentially, as soon as this plan was announced, it got tied down in legal challenges, both here in Italy and also at European level, particularly around what are called safe countries. So sending people back to countries which are deemed as not being safe. From what I can glean, trying to understand how many people have actually been sent to these centres, reports would suggest it's around 300 people so far have been sent to Albania, which obviously is way less than the 36,000 a year that was planned for.
Madeleine, if I can bring you back in, the Home Secretary has said that she's exploring the use of return hubs for asylum seekers too. I think we should be clear, these hubs are not the same as the Rwandan plan was.
That's correct. So these would be hubs for people who've been refused asylum in the UK to be sent to, whereas the Rwanda programme was for people who'd applied for asylum, not had a decision, neither a grant nor a refusal, and would be sent to Rwanda for their claim to be processed there. So it is quite a different model.
So it actually means you're deporting people not to a country, but to a hub.
Yes, so the idea would be that the UK, like many other countries, struggles to remove people after they've been refused asylum, and that they believe it would be easier to deport people from a third country once they're no longer in the UK and therefore have perhaps less desire to fight their removal. But we actually don't know a huge amount about how these hubs affect migrants and their decision-making and plans, partly because it's one of these things that gets discussed and usually not implemented, and that's been the case for years. And so this is in the category of things where I'll believe it when I see it.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Susie, we've mentioned temporary refugee status and return hubs. What is the rest of Europe doing in terms of added restrictions? I mean, the two big places, one in terms of percentages, I think, and the other terms in sheer numbers, are Sweden and Germany.
There are three broad themes that you can see when you look across at the tools that European countries are trying to bring in at the moment. The first is around a focus on making processes more effective. And I would sort of put France and the 2024 asylum law, which was trying to speed up both the processing of applications, but also to make more effective this question of deportation. I think the sort of process focus has also been a big feature of what Sweden has been trying to do, looking particularly at the returns angle. Then the second basket, I would say, is this question about making a country less attractive as a destination. This was very much one of the pillars that I was referring to in the Danish model, but I would say that Germany's approach around this has also been quite apparent. We've seen the new coalition government in Germany tighten the right to family reunification for those who have had successful asylum claims and limit the rights that come with successful asylum claims. And that is about sort of trying to ensure that there isn't kind of asylum shopping within Europe in terms of some countries offering more beneficial regimes than others. But then a kind of a third basket of work, I think, is around integration. You know, this has been another element of France's recent asylum law on the kind of the path to integration, focusing on the sort of the values, the language, the civic aspect of that.
Andrew, can we just talk about deportation for a moment, since that is always one of the things which people are talking about? What's been happening in Europe with regard to increasing the number of deportations and the measures that have been taken in order to facilitate this?
If we look across Europe, we see the rate of return. So that's the number of people for whom a return decision is issued compared to those who actually returned, hovers at around 20 to 25%. So just to pin that down a little bit more to give a sense of scale, in 2024, across the EU, 485,000 return orders were issued by an EU member state. But of these, about 111,000 people are actually returned. And there's two ways to return people. One is voluntary, which is the preferred route. One is forced. So in 2024, of the 111,000 who were returned, 60% were voluntary, 40% were forced. What we're seeing is around one in five people with a return order are actually returned. And it becomes a major problem for an asylum policy, and because it means that decisions on a person's right to protect and status, to be a refugee or to have a protection status, can actually have relatively little effect on whether they stay or not. So I think deportation or returns has been a hugely challenging issue across the EU. And the member states now of the EU, again, are trying to address this by putting in place what they call a European system of returns, so that a decision made in one member state is also recognised in another member state.
Madeline, how does the UK do when it comes to deporting asylum seekers now?
This has changed over time. So it used to be that a majority of people who were not successful in their asylum application were removed, say 10 or 15 years ago. That has changed, and now it is well under half. It fluctuates a bit. It varies a lot by country. Denmark actually is on the higher end at roughly 50%, and then there are countries like France where it's less than 10%. But across the board, this is something that countries struggle with.
Why?
There are various different barriers to returns. Some are just practical and logistical, finding people and understanding where they are, and that sort of sometimes physical process of forcing people onto planes is harder than people often imagine when they discuss this. We then also have legal challenges. So there are legal protections that enable people to argue that they should not be removed. Sometimes they're successful. In other cases, they're not successful, but that process of going through the challenges also takes time and sometimes can make it difficult to execute the removal. And then there are crucial set of problems around the cooperation of countries of origin, because you can't just, you know, get people on a plane and dump them in a country without that country's consent. So you do need some cooperation. And often countries will not recognise people as their citizens, or maybe they recognise them, but it takes them a very long time to provide any kind of documentation, or, you know, travel documentation for them to move. So all of those things mean that it's much harder than it sounds to remove people.
Can we just talk a moment about the logistics? How many people per year do we deport now? Is that a costly business? And roughly how many people in the future would we need to deport every year in order to do the thing the government seems to want to do?
Right. So the number of people actually being returned from the UK has changed dramatically over time. Last year, it was roughly 30, 35,000. And that was actually up from this low point during the pandemic. There's been an upward trend, but it's still well below the numbers that we saw in, say, 2014, 2015.
Are these all forcibly deported, or are some of them kind of given inducements to go away?
No. So the majority leave voluntarily. About a third of the total are people who actually have no contact with the government at all. There's an argument that they don't really even count as returns. So this might be someone who overstayed a visa for 1 or 2 months and then left of their own accord. They've never had any contact with the authorities. About 25% are people who do an enforced removal, and then the rest would be people returning voluntarily with some assistance from the government. Now, what the government prefers, of course, is for people to return voluntarily because it's considered both more humane and it's much less expensive than having chartered flights, have people escorted on, sometimes by multiple escorts. That process of an enforced removal is both expensive and very difficult and can be quite traumatic for the individuals involved as well.
Susie, is there any indication that where deportation rates have been higher, or indeed where actually people have been deterred, what actually happens to these people? I mean, I'm presuming that they don't disappear off the face of the earth. They exist somewhere. So where do they go if they're deported?
In reality, where it is forced rather than voluntary, then you are looking at the government of the country to which the asylum seeker has come, trying to find a solution that is based on who will take them rather than where they are necessarily from. This is why we're seeing the increasing focus on deals with third countries outside the EU. But when they are not part of one of those deals, I think in reality, they don't disappear off the face of the earth, but they do quite often disappear off the administrative systems and they go into the black market. And I wanted to raise the example of Spain as one European country that has sort of bucked the trend in recent years in the sense of trying to show itself as less welcoming. It took quite a bold political decision under Sanchez's government last year to offer an amnesty to, I think the plan is, 1 million illegal immigrants in Spain over 3 years in order to regularise those individuals, to get them back into the system, into paying taxes, into being able to contribute more easily in society and integrate in Spain more broadly.
But Andrew, I imagine that in the case of the Spanish example, they're regularising people who are already there. And quite a lot of these policies are actually looking at people who have yet to arrive in countries. Are we to assume that the Spanish are saying we'll regularise people who are here, but we're going to be a bit tougher now about who can come in? Is that what's happening?
Spain is very keen to see a coherent EU response, which might allow it to have more effective control of its borders. I think that's a very good way of putting it. And I would also compare with Italy as well, because Italy has engaged in quite large-scale regularisations over years, even right-wing governments. And Italy, at the moment, is not saying that it's going to regularise, but it is creating very significant pathways for migrants to enter Italy. But I think that the core dilemma is this sense that there is a system, there is some kind of control or regulation, and also you're dealing with this very difficult position of large numbers of people who are essentially outside of the domain of the state, open to exploitation and not paying tax.
Andrew, can we talk about something which plays quite big in Britain? This is the question about whether or not the European Convention on Human Rights has been a significant drag on countries trying to decide their own policies. We've talked about some of the harder line policies now, if you call them that, in places like Denmark and Italy. Have they found problems with the convention?
What we see now is pushback against the convention, arguing that it's out of date and it's not allowing governments to respond to the demands of their citizens on migration. And that was precisely the contents of a letter that was initiated by Giorgia Meloni, Prime Minister of Italy, and Mette Frederiksen, Prime Minister of Denmark, in May this year, with seven other EU member states, including Poland. So there is some momentum behind this. So it's not just in the UK we're seeing this debate, although I would say that the nuclear button, as you might put it, of leaving the ECHR, I don't think is seen as a kind of serious proposition.
Madeline, what do you understand from the government's white paper is its position with regard to the ECHR?
So the government has said that they want to stay in the ECHR. And my reading of the white paper proposals is they're effectively trying to go as far as possible to restrict the scope of ECHR and reduce the legal protections that people have that enable them to challenge their removal while remaining compliant with the convention. And obviously that's a difficult balancing act. So ECHR creates a balancing exercise, and it says that the state has a legitimate interest in being able to enforce immigration policies and remove people from the country, and that that needs to then be balanced against people's right to family life. And so this question is always, how is this one thing balanced against the other? And what the government wants to do is create some wording that encourages the judges to shift that balance towards the interest in enforcing immigration policy and put less weight on family life.
And is it your understanding, through what you've looked at and the research you've done, that can be achieved?
These discussions have been going on for some time. I think it may be difficult to find the precise wording because the government can't say, you know, we really want about 5% of people to succeed, not 20%, not more, because they, at the end of the day, they have to find a formulation of words like exceptional or extremely exceptional. And it's very difficult to predict precisely how judges are going to respond to that.
Madeline, one of the most obviously radical changes, of course, is the 20 years before you can get permanent status. Do we have any idea how this would work? And do we have any idea what the impact actually would be on the people involved, communities and so on, of making such a change?
There are lots of different types of impacts this could have. The government is hoping that it will deter people from coming to the UK in the first place because they will see that it's going to be a long and arduous process to get permanent status. I'm slightly sceptical as to whether the 20 years on its own will have that impact. It's the kind of thing that people might discover about once they've already arrived. And there may be people who, for example, perhaps have been already refused asylum in an EU country and feel that they don't have any options. And so they're willing to deal with the 20 years, even if they don't like it. I think that the challenge that the government faces is it's got these two goals, right? So it wants to deter people from coming to the UK by putting in place a less attractive set of conditions for them. But then if people are going to come here and they're going to spend the rest of their lives here, then it wants them to be able to integrate and to flourish and set down roots. And the problem is that the same set of policies often that make life more uncomfortable and that act as a deterrent are the ones that also make it harder for people to integrate. And so there is some evidence that access to a secure permanent status and to citizenship, which is the next step after permanent status, can help people integrate both economically and socially.
And finally, how does the UK package compare now with the rest of Europe? We've talked a bit about the rest of Europe. Is it fair to say, as I think the government seems to suggest, that we will then be the toughest and taking the most action in order to get the problem down?
There are different ways of measuring what's tough. So, for example, you can look at the share of people who are granted asylum at all, which varies a lot, but is, you know, reasonably similar in the UK to many other EU countries. If you look specifically at the package that once someone has been granted refugee status, they would get, then yes, a 20-year route to settlement would make the UK particularly restrictive. We have 10 years in Switzerland, 8 years in Denmark, although some people may take longer than that or struggle to meet their criteria. But the norm in EU countries would be 5 years.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Madeline Sumption, Susie Dennison and Andrew Geddes. And we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Cordelia Hemming and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, I'm Kimberly Wilson, I'm a psychologist, and in my new podcast, Complex, I'll be your guide through all the information and misinformation that's out there about mental health. I'm joined by expert guests covering topics from people-pleasing to perfectionism, burnout to empathy, to find tangible advice so we can understand ourselves a little better. Complex, with me, Kimberly Wilson. Listen on BBC Sounds.